You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Our interviewer tonight is Andrew Lam, who is an editor and the co-founder of New American Media. Andrew was born in Vietnam and moved to the United States when he was 11. You may have heard Andrew's essays on National Public Radio's All Things Considered for the last 8 years, and his books Perfume Dreams, Reflections on the Vietnamese Diaspora won the Pan American Beyond the Margins Award in 2006, and his new book East Eats West, it's a great title, Writing in Two Hemispheres, was recently published, and we have Andrew's books for sale tonight, along with Maxine Hong Kingston's, courtesy of our library store. That Maxine Hong Kingston is a great writer is a fact well known. She's the author of The Woman Warrior, Chinamen, Tripmaster Monkey, and the Fifth Book of Peace, among her other works. She's the recipient of numerous awards, including the National Book Award and the Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters from the National Book Foundation. Her work is known for its leaps of imaginative sympathy and narrative magic. And in addition, some of you, perhaps many of you know, that Maxine is also a teacher, a mentor, a peace activist, a bodhisattva. She's been arrested in front of the White House for protesting the invasion of Iraq. She's led writing and meditation workshops for veterans and their families. Her marvelous new memoir, I Love a Broad Margin to My Life, weaves together wisdom gleaned from her many journeys. While reading her book last night, I jotted down wide open mind, wide open eyes, wide open heart, peace woman, peace dragon, mentor, guide, teacher. She asks the president to call off shock and awe, a bouquet knot of pink roses staring down the SWAT team. All my life, Maxine writes in the preface to the anthology, Veterans of War, Veterans of Peace, which she edited, she said, I have wanted to keep soldiers safe from war. Towards the end of the day, in one of her veterans workshops, this is what she does. Before the participants read their work, Maxine always invokes Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassionate listening. We aspire to learn your way of listening in order to help relieve the suffering of the world. So tonight, I thought we could all listen to Maxine and practice that same spirit of compassionate listening that she evokes. So I will ring the bell. And ask you to please welcome Maxine Hong Kingston and Andrew Lam to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Louise, and thank you, everyone, for this wonderful welcome. I have to break the news to you that this new book, I Love a Broad Margin to My Life, is a poem. This is a 225-page poem. And I made this departure from prose, which I've been working on for, 50 years, 60 years. I've been writing prose, and then when I got to be 65 years old, I thought I can't afford to spend 10 years on a book, a decade. So let me speed up the pace of creation by writing it in poetry. But actually, poetry is not such a great departure from what I did when I was a child. And so I want to start by reading you the first poem that I ever invented in my life. I can't say it's the first poem I ever wrote because this was before I could write. And I guess I must have been about 3 years old. And this is the language that I used. The setting of this poem is that we lived in a two-story building, and our family was on the top floor, and my mother would open up the window, and the two of us would watch for my grandfathers, who owned a stagecoach, which they converted into a vegetable wagon, and they had two black horses, and then when we could hear the horses coming, my mother would hang me out the window and she'd say, "Sing to your grandfathers, you know, tell them a joke, make them laugh, tell them a poem." So here's the poem. Sam gunga, say gunga, ne hoi naia, ma hai kup kup, say gyok, yao say gyok, ne hoi naia. And I translated it decades later. Hey, third grandfather. Hey, fourth grandfather. Where are you going? Horseshoes clippity-clopping, 4 feet, then 4 feet. Where are you going? Okay, so that was my first poem. And now I'm going to read to you from my latest poem. Trying to find a structure for this journey that I make in this long poem, I thought about a Chinese scroll and how it unrolls. And as it unrolls, you can see the countryside that one is traveling through. And so in this poem, I travel through China, going to the countryside where every village can be different from every other village. And then one of my characteristics and a characteristic that happens in the poem too is I get lost as I go on this journey because I have no sense of direction. And though I am traveling through China, somehow I am in this village in Vietnam. And Vietnam is right south of where my family villages are. Go on. Alone. I have no sense of direction. Left, right, east, west, arbitrary to my instincts. Mother taught me, memorize, face the black rocking chair, place your arms on its arms, the scissors, the pencil you hold in this hand, this side of the rocking chair. I've been lost, taking a walk with our toddling son into nature. Sun upon and between the shaking leaves forms images of rivers and houses and people coming to the rescue. I shouted and screamed for rescue. Our boy said, "We can eat the flies." I've been lost taking a solitary walk in my own neighborhood where the streets curve around and I circle and circle. Earl drove around until he found me. I walked very, very mindfully into the Grand Canyon, down the great unknown, lost sight of any person and did not get lost, and walked back up to the top. I followed a deer who did not run away from me, and I did not get lost. Maps of China were made for me by Columbus and Kafka. The most beautiful thing that Columbus had ever seen was the land, gardens, wholly bright green. He walked among the trees, which grew 5 kinds of leaves and fruit branching from one trunk. The greatest wonder in the new world, he said, was diversity. A man alone in a canoe rode by. He was bringing bread from island to island. Kafka heard from an unknown boatman that a great wall will be built to box in the center, which is itself a series of box mazes, all contained within the endless outside wall. Villages, cities, each further maze. The ruler of the center has a message for us. He whispers it into the messenger's ear, has it whispered back, nods, then dies. To get to us, the way goes from innermost courts, up mountains of staircases and stiles over walls, down stairs and more stairs to an outer palace, onward to the next outer palace, the next, more courts, more stairs, more mazy palaces. Years and years go by, and I am traveling the other way, inward to the center. Must not tire, must not grow old and want to die. After years and miles of travel and worry, keeping west, keeping south, I come to a home-like village in Vietnam. All the land from the Yangtze River to Quang Tri had been Nam Viet, Nan Yu. The Hung, Hong Bang kings ruled for 2,621 years. I was on a boat in the Pearl River Delta. My mother in a boat going the other way, hiding under a pile of oranges, escaping from the Japanese, catching the big ship to meet my father in America. And next thing I knew, I was in the Red River Delta. The same pearlescent water changing colors with the tropical sun, the same red dirt and gray dirt and black dirt, same as the San Joaquin Delta back home. The farmers grow rice. They treasure the water buffaloes, name them names like Great Joy. The people look same Chinese. The like of the same I feel, the like of the same in others. But an utterly foreign language chimes out of their mouths. Flashback to the first day of American school, other children, but I can't speak with them. I wanted to say, you smell like milk, your skin looks like chocolate ice cream, and yours like strawberry and vanilla ice cream. I wanted to ask, how do you feel being you? I arrived at the hamlet on a holiday. The hot breeze, hot even beside the hurrying river, blue and flew flags, long banners, tassels, long ribbons, lots of red, not just political red, red for health, for beauty, for good luck. Clang, 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 bang, bang, honk, quoo, bum, bum. The musicians played freestyle, no pattern, free for all, any old way. Broke patterns, broke time. And firecrackers went off every which way. Firecrackers like bombs and artillery fire and rocket fire. They aren't afraid, the bang setting off PTSD. No more PTSD. PTSD over. War over. War won. They won every war. The American War, and before that, war with the French, and before that, the Japanese, and before that, the Chinese. They invited me into a tent open on one side, sat me at the picnic table, and served me jung. Just like back home, untie the string. What message are these lines and knots telling me if I could but read? Unwrap the tea leaves, tea sacred in every country where it grows. Eat the rice and mung beans, the pork and the whole sun of egg yolk. I partake of Jung with the once enemy. Does Jung mean to them what it means to me? They are eating peace food with their twice enemy, an American, a Chinese. Chinese invented Jung to feed the dragons in the river. To feed the dragons in the river where Chu Ping, the peace martyr, drowned himself. Clang, clang, kang, boom, 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 kang, bum, bum, kang, kang, quoo. Come on, come on, come on. I was rushed out of the tent into a rushing crowd. Everyone, all of the hamlet and other hamlets, out of the rolling ocean, the crowd, around corners and bends, stream more crowd, hurrying, hurrying somewhere wonderful. Above heads lifted and carried on chairs, thrones moved a parade of idols. Who were they? Gods? Heroes? Ancestors? They had big, wide-open eyes, as if they could see all things and all people, see far to where we're going. I could not recognize the figures by a sign. No antler bumps on head, no red face, no blue face, no long ears, no mudra of hands, no multiple hands, no multiple heads. They looked like regular people, dressed up in silk and gold raiment and crowns. The crowd slowed, so tight were we. We fitted ourselves breast to back, sides to sides. No elbow poking, no stepping on toes or heels. Over our heads, the roomy sky was benign blue. The clouds were long and wispy. The crowd up ahead moved faster, drawing, pulling my part of crowd after them, faster, faster. I'm a short person. All I can see are backs. Where are the friends I had Jung with? I can't see the idols anymore either. I look at the sky, trying but unable to project my point of view to see the whole crowd and the country it's moving through, whether there's a destination, and to find the people I'd know. I could lift my feet, leave the ground, and the close-fitting crowd would carry me. I don't have to watch or decide where I'm going. I stayed in step, running on tiptoes. The ground was dirt and trodden grass. The dirt was damp, damper wet. We were beside the river. We were following the snaking path of the long river. Song Hong, River Red, the Red River, which goes from the Yunnan River in China to the Gulf of Tonkin. The river is full of dragons. The river is a dragon. Vietnam is a dragon rampant. She has a large head, many mouths, and a long spine that flares into fantails. And I'm a dragon, and my mother a dragon. I and all these people are drops of dragon within the big dragon body. We are blood. We are performing dragon. Every so often, Chinese have to mass together, become a mashing, moshing crowd. In the United States, lonely, you can join the people in Chinatown shopping for their daily greens and get your fix of Chinese crowd. But those crowds move in both directions, pass one another, coming and going. This mass I'm embedded in feels like a Japanese or Korean demo, like an advancing army. Breaching worry. Worry is the default working of my natural mind. I feel elation, crowd joy, happiness in people.
Maxine, first of all, I have to say that last week when I told friends who are teaching Asian American studies that I'm going to share the same stage with you, and one of them say, "Oh my gosh, it's like you trying to open for Madonna."
Oh, my God.
Oh yeah, and I thought, yeah, or Lady Gaga for younger folks out there, and I'm not even sure what I am, but it is such an honor to be on the same stage with you.
Thank you, but actually, I felt that I was opening for Andrew Lamb, and that was. was the reason that I read this section on Vietnam, yes, because I know that's your mother country, and I wanted to read a section in which our people,
yeah,
could
my mother is from that section where you talked about the Red River Delta in, of the North. And I think it's such a California story, such that a Vietnamese boy is interviewing an honorific Chinese lady on East Asia, Southeast Asia narrative, and it becomes a California story. But let's talk about writing, because I find that a lot of writers wouldn't take the kind of risks you do, going from prose to poetry, because I won't name names, but people, once they're successful with a certain genre, they would stick with it because it's lucrative and they don't want to lose that position. And what I admire so much about you is that you actually take risks to go from prose, where you're so known and your work is known around the world, to do poetry. What do you make of that risk?
Well, basically, I can't help it. maybe you've noticed that every book I write is a different genre.
Yeah.
You know, so I will write the essay and the personal essay, the autobiography, fiction, mm-hmm, and nonfiction, and poetry. So I think it's, I don't seem to have a choice. It seems as if the story I want to tell or what I want to say, it just seems to take a certain form, and I have to go in that direction.
And you blur borders, certainly, including from the first book, The Woman Warrior, where mythology and personal biography blur. And in this case, you also take your fictional character with you when you travel to China. You know, Whitman Assing is there doing stuff, and his wife Tara as well, farming. And it's almost as if the whole world is traveling with you, and the personal become the transnational, the interpersonal. And it makes into a kind of a kind of spiritual journey, seems to me, mm-hmm, in the writing.
Mm-hmm. In this book, I take this long journey, and you're right, I want to bring everyone with me, and including my fictional characters, and I think this is just it has to do with my, when I was a kid, I had lots of imaginary friends. I mean, not just one imaginary friend. I had armies of imaginary friends. And when I thought about taking a long journey, I realized that I never travel alone. And I have to bring everyone with me. And then there is a crisis in the book when I think, well, I need to let go of all of the crutches, the allies. What and who will I be if I were alone? Mm. And so there comes a time in the book where I let the fictional characters go,
mm-hmm,
and then I go on with the real alone self.
And it took you some years to finish this prose poem. You started when you were 65, and then it kind of ended, and I'm not sure how many years after, but it ended, and in fact, it's been reported and written about the last few days in the Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, where in which the title says something like, "This is your last book." And everyone I know was sort of disturbed by that, like, how could that be your last book? And in when you were ending your poem, you're talking about not wanting to be a writer anymore, but a reader, and that you would like to watch the world rather than minding it. And I had always thought great writers would like to, in fact, I imagine, I'm not a great writer, but I would imagine the end of day where I would die in middle sentence, and it's a way one would. So that, what is life like if you're going to stop writing? Or is that even possible for you?
Well, it's sort of a daydream or a goal. That wouldn't it be wonderful to come to a time in your life when you have said all you needed to say,
yeah,
And, you know, I was thinking about Colette,
I see.
The great French writer who at the age of 80-something really felt that she had completed her life's work. Mm-hmm. And I want to be at that place where I have completed my life's work. When I came to the end of this poem, I actually felt that way, that I had said everything I wanted to say. And wouldn't it be wonderful if I could just stop now?
Yes, but then what? I mean, as someone who's been writing for nearly 2 decades, even if I don't write more than just 3 or 4 sentences, just 5 minutes or 10 minutes of a day when I'm really busy, I feel like I'm cheating myself out of something.
You feel like life is a waste.
Yeah.
I mean, you have just wasted all your time. And what's the use of even living if you aren't creating something?
Yeah.
You're just a good for nothing if you don't get some of that writing done. Yeah.
But then you also have regrets. And in fact, in the Chronicle, they interview your son where you say that in the Chronicle, I'm not sure everyone was seen it in the San Francisco Chronicle, where you say when you were younger, you would give him a whole bag of marshmallow so that you would have extra 20 minutes to write. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, that was so bad because you know, he couldn't, it was the marshmallow bag was shut, and the idea was that he would figure out how to open it. I didn't even think until much later he could have choked on the plastic. But, you know what you do for art.
Yeah. So, wouldn't you say that it's kind of late to regret it now? Because,
the
kind of art you have built and the things you have done to regret it.
Yeah, it's too late.
Anyway, he was interviewed in the piece, and he said, no, he had a wonderful time. And, you said that he complained that there was no food in the house. But, in fact, he said his complaint was that there was just always too healthy food in the house.
Yeah, I think he was just trying to make me feel better.
Oh, that's so nice of him.
But your question about what to do next?
Yeah.
At the end of this poem, I make a list of all the people I know who've died. A lot of people died in the 4 years in which I was writing the poem, and the feeling that I have when people die is that I want to go with them.
Yes,
and then I think, I must think of reasons why I want to keep living and to stay alive. So I end the poem with reasons to keep living. And then I put one, and then I put all the different reasons. I think I come up with about 7. After I wrote them down, I thought, you know what? This looks like a to-do list. and so that'll keep me alive. But here's one that things I wrote down, and I think this relates to you too, Andrew. One of the things that I say that I feel that I must do before I stop writing is that my father was a poet. Mm-hmm. And he wrote on the margins of my of The Woman Warrior and China Men. And this is in the Chinese editions, which have wide margins. And so he would reply to my book throughout the book. He would write poems in reply. Old Chinese tradition, you know, where poets write back and forth to one another. And so I think, you know, I've really got to go through his poems and translate them and put them into poetic English, and then maybe I can reply back to him. And I'm thinking of you because I know that your father is a writer too.
Yeah.
And I want to know, how is it to be the son of a writer?
My father is somewhat of a super achiever, and so it's a bit competitive with him. When I have my second book out, he say, actually, I've written 3.
Oh,
no.
Gosh, so it's numbers.
Yeah, it's a very machismo game my father plays. Oh. But but it's just, you know, I think in some way I still try to honor him while, you know, write about family issues. And in some way, I also want to talk to you about that whole problem about secrets and telling story, because my family are very proud that I became a journalist and writer, but on the other hand, they're very wary of what I'm going to say next. And there's an uncle who visits once in a while, and every time he sees me, he say, "Are you going to quote me if I say this?" You know, and so there is this weird thing where I kind of think back to Norman Miller, where he asked about, you know, being a writer in a family, and he basically say something along the line that, well, you know, when there's a writer born into that family, that family is basically screwed. So, and you know, I mean, the Women Warriors is famous for the fact that the mother say, "Don't tell the secret," and that was the secret that was told right at the front page. But you know, so so what is that tension between holding it in and not telling it and telling it? You know, you were being interviewed, in fact, about your parents, and it turned out that they were undocumented.
Yes, they are.
And please talk about that, that secret that you held for a long, long time until they passed away.
Well, that's one secret that my parents, that was what they really bothered them, that if I told too much, that that immigration would come and deport all of us.
Yeah.
And they would say, you know, they would say, the whole family, we would all get deported. And I think that kind of revealing secrets, but revealing them in a certain way, this is what makes me write the way I do. And I write in a way where people are reading and they say, "Is this fiction or is this nonfiction?
Yeah.
What is she doing? Is this mythic or did it really happen?" And I think I did that on purpose, because I was thinking, if anybody from the INS read my books,
yeah,
they couldn't trace it. but actually, my parents, they were not undocumented immigrants. They were well documented immigrants. The papers were so fake, but they were so they were so legally correct. Yeah. That, you know, my brothers passed top secret security clearance when they were in the military. And there was no way that they could trace our family because the papers were so well written.
Well forged.
Well forged, yes. But, you know, the answer to how do you tell these important truths,
yeah,
of the family, and how do you write it so that they don't disown you and get mad at you? You know what it is. The story form, story itself, is a miraculous form. You take material, events, conflicts. And you process it through art. You write dramatic scenes, and you have your enemy characters, and they clash, and there's this great climax in which you let out all of the angry, tragic emotions, and you find all the words for it, you find all the scenes for it, and then you keep going, and the story always comes to resolution, and by the end there is meaning, there's revelation, there's resolution, and then you have this complete wonderful story in which you have found the meaning, the beauty, the order which was not present in actual life. So once you have told a story in that way, when the family reads it, they'll say, oh, that's so wonderful. Those characters are so lovable. See, what happens is the great writer writes with compassion.
Yeah.
And that is what comes across in the story. And so when mother reads it, she says, well, isn't that wonderful? Didn't we act well?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, along that line, and I think it's kind of relevant to bring a political issue in, because you addressed the whole issue of being immigrants or children of immigrants and the racism treated against Asians in particular. And now we're in sort of in the thrall now of this anti-immigrant wave. Certainly it comes out of Arizona in big stories. At what point does fiction help heal or deal with issues, something as wracking as the immigration issue that we're faced with these days? It feels to me, at least, like we're now setting up stages where we say good immigrant versus bad immigrant, legal versus illegal, and sort of categorize them on so many different levels. But in fact, we're all humans. So how would you would say art and fiction deal with that issue?
I think that through fiction, through art, we can see points of view, and we can write characters from their own deep personal point of view, even though an enemy person. If you write from that person's point of view, then you can understand all of it. To me, a great immigration novel is Grapes of Wrath.
Yes, absolutely.
And here they take this great journey across America. There's so much hatred of those Okies all along the way. And all the time we see from their point of view what's happening, and so you have this great sympathy for them. I was just reading a book by Ben Daniel, and the name of it is Neighbors, and there's a subtitle something like the biblical view of immigration, and he writes about basically about the immigration from Mexico, but he looks at the whole Bible as a story of migration. I mean, right from the beginning, we get that exile, and then after that, that exodus, going all from one country to another. The Good Samaritan was, you know, he wasn't one of the locals. He was from Samaria, Jesus and his parents. I mean, they were on the move, and so he interprets the entire Bible as a story of human migration, and what are our responsibilities toward our neighbors who are moving from country to country.
Along with immigration, I guess we also have many cultural changes, and every wave of immigration that comes to the United States, they don't just bring themselves, but music, songs, poetry, food. There's a new thing that I just told you about in San Francisco now called the Sushirito. And in LA, there is this thing called kogi, which is a Korean taco. So food changes and cultures changes, and we see things being changed all the time, and also clashes. And I'm dying to ask you this question, because people ask me to ask this question. What do you make of Amy Chua's new book on the tiger, the hymn of the Battle of Tiger? Basically, you know, the big brouhaha is that she was in the Wall Street Journal talking about how the superiority of Chinese mother sort of, you know, treating kids with this draconian method, but they become super elite kids who can play Mozart and go to, you know, Ivy League school. And on the other hand, you grew up with kind of a dragon mother in a way, but then you're pretty lax with your kid because you let him play, write poetry and play music. And so what do you make of this clash now that's the big talk in America about the battle of the mommies?
I think probably the popularity of that Tiger Mother book has to do with the perception that that we are a model minority, yeah. That we are super students, and you know, we'll be 40% of the University of California, and how do we do it? It must be because, you know, the mothers are just whipping us into shape. I think that's what that has to do with. I find it. It's interesting that that book comes out at the same time as this one, and here, and I talk about, you know, oh, you don't have to go to college if you don't want. It's just fine. And I'm saying, you know, you want to be a music. Oh, I got to tell you this one. This is the kind of mother I am. We were here in Los Angeles, my husband and I and our son, and we and some nieces, and we were at the La Brea Tar Pits, yep. And we were looking at everything, and there was a street person, a street musician, and he was sitting on the ground. He was really dirty and straggly, and he had a little cup for money, and he was playing a guitar, and our son runs up to us and says, "What do you think if I grew up and I became like him?" And he was so excited. He was so happy. He had found his role model. And we said, "Well, of course. That's a great idea." And so that's what happened. Okay, so that's what you do. I mean, enough of this tiger mother stuff. You got to be a dragon mother like me.
Okay, let's move on. I love this. Let's move on to this whole anti-war movement, which you've been very entrenched in. I find it really funny in a way that, you know, 1 year you were giving the presidential medal, and then a few years later you chain yourself to the White House fence protesting the war.
Oh, I'm so glad you caught that, because I felt that way too. Yeah. I remember here we were inside the White House, and there was a dinner dance and all this food, and it was. It was so beautiful and so magical. Everything was so bright, and we didn't want to leave. And then the next thing, we're on the outside of the fence, and you can't get in, and you can't see the president, and they've locked you out, and they arrest you, and you know, it just goes to show your status.
Yeah.
Changing.
But it's kind of comical because the way you wrote about it here in this book, basically you talk about being chained to Alice Walker and it gets to the nitty-gritty where you need to pee and you ask her to pour your pants.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, it didn't seem funny at the time.
I mean, it's funny now reading it.
Actually, we were not chained together. Oh. And, she had her separate handcuffs and I had my separate handcuffs. And Terry Tempest Williams was in our jail cell also. Oh.
And a literary gathering.
Yeah. But Terry Tempest Williams has, she's been arrested many, many times for protesting the bomb testing in the desert. in Utah. And so she has a lot of experience with jails. And I did not. And I didn't know, you know, pretty soon, you know, you have a toilet there. Pretty soon the toilet is getting full, and nobody knows what to do, but Terry knew what to do. And what you do is you have to bang on the cell door, and then when somebody comes, you say, "Please, sir, could you flush the toilet?" Mm. And they flush it from the outside, because I guess they don't want you to be putting any evidence down the toilet. So, you know, isn't that weird? You go to jail for this noble cause, and you come out with a whole bunch of toilet stories. I mean, because that becomes very important to you when you're in that cell.
Well, one of the more poignant part of the interview in the Chronicle was the interview a vet who basically said that if he didn't come to your writing workshop, he wouldn't have been alive. And I thought it was such an important work that you do that help people who have a lot of anger to find a way to forge them into poetry, into stories. And yet, you know, I've been on panels in which people ask me, well, what roles do you think art and writing have to do with, how can it plays in fighting against, you know, violence and atrocity? And I have to say, my answer was pretty negative in the sense that I, you know, with all the Dostoevskys and Tolstoys in the world, you know, Russia fell into terrible situations. And so I'm not sure what you make of the role of art in face of human tragedies.
Yeah, I asked that same question in this book, in that there were, at this demonstration in Washington, D.C., it was before shock and awe began. And what we were thinking of was, is there a way to prevent this war from happening? And so it was a gathering of artists, dancers, musicians, you know, the puppeteers, storytellers, drummers, and so all these people were performing their art there in front of the White House, with the big hope that somehow art can prevent war. And then we were arrested, and then the bombing started about 2.5 weeks later. And then I question, you know, what good does it do? Does art really bring about peace? But, you know, I think what we need to do is just think of the long term. I do believe that the protests and everybody, things that everybody did during the Vietnam War, it did bring the war to an end. And I think we should take credit for it. It's just that it's not going to be done in 1 year or 2 years or, you know, it takes a long time. Pacifists have to think in the long term. I was talking to one of the Vietnam War veterans in our writers group, and I was feeling full of despair, and I was just and I just asked him. This is a poet. His name is Ted Sexauer, and I said, you know, I mean, what good did pacifism ever do the Dalai Lama? Look at him. He has lost his country. He's got all those monks and nuns are tortured, and they're in jail. They're losing their natural resources. Things. I mean, so what's the point of continuing his nonviolence? Why not jump in there and fight for Tibet? And I must say, Ted looked at me with such surprise. He just, that this would be coming from me.
Yeah.
And he says, "Oh, but the story isn't over." And I understood that to mean that how wonderful that the Dalai Lama can hang on to his ideals, even though everybody around him can give up on nonviolence. He'll hang on to that idea and continue working. And who knows, in the next incarnation, Tibet and China will be okay again.
We come to a point where I want to ask you, because it plays such a strong role in a lot of your writing, and including my own, is the role of ghost. Because I came from a country in which practically 9.9% out of 10, I mean 9.9 people out of 10, would believe in ghosts. And ghosts play such a strong role in your writing. And do you believe in ghosts? What do you make of ghosts? And what role should it play in literature?
You know, when I write about ghosts, I think they are not only the spirits that float around, but there are also ghosts of history. And there's psychological ghosts that haunt me and haunt everyone. So there are all kinds of ghosts that come around us all the time. In my writing, I would also call white people ghosts. And I would say that there's the meter reader ghost, or the police ghost, and there's the teacher ghost. And when I'm writing like that, it's when you don't know people, then they are ghosts. But when you get to know them, and then they become human. And you can relate to them as human instead of these mysterious, fearful creatures. Another way I relate to ghosts is that the ghost story is the most fascinating story, and I wanted to tell ghost stories, but and because I knew that readers would enjoy reading them. But then I can make the ghosts all different kinds. But then, you know, you were saying how many Vietnamese people believe in them.
No.
I must say I rarely see ghosts, but...
Meaning you have seen ghosts.
I've smelled them. But see, a smell that is sort of invisible. Yeah. So you can smell, but... But everybody around me sees them, like my son and my mother, and my sister. It's they seem to see them very clearly, and they can interact with them. And for me, they're more at a distance.
Well, I think it's time to open up for Q&A, and folks can go to the mics. Two people with microphones and. And raise your hands, please. And over there.
I wonder if you could say something about, you know, in one of your books I was just looking at, you talked about how you wanted to keep soldiers from war and how that came to be your preoccupation.
I have been... fascinated and haunted by soldiers as far back as I can remember. And when I was a kid, my cousins in uniform would be coming and going. They'd be on their way to their fort or to the Pacific, or they're going the other way to some other military base, and I remember them going, and I also remember them coming back after World War II, and then in those years, there was so much of the war. We'd get the Chinese newspapers, and there'd be pictures of water torture by the Japanese torturing Chinese, and pictures of the experiments that were in the death camps, and we also there were big fundraising drives to send money to China. And but what I remember most shocking was my mother taking me to the first movie that I ever saw, and all of a sudden, great big black and white battle scenes, guns going off and people screaming and falling over, and I just went into a panic hysteria. And my mother had to drag me out of there. I didn't even know it was a movie, and of course, as a child, when I was young, the bomb was dropped twice on Japan, and I knew about that, and I was so horrified. And so that I think all my life I've thought, what am I going to do to stop this? I'm going to stop this. I took responsibility for it.
Next question. Over here?
Oh,
yes. Yeah.
This little
girl. Oh. Oh, yes.
Why is the river a dragon?
Oh, why is the Red River a dragon? Oh, because you know how dragons move like this, and dragons have a lot of mist that comes out of their mouths, and Chinese people believe that dragons are made out of water. You know how American people and Western people, they think dragons are full of fire and they spit out fire. But Chinese people and Eastern people, we think of the dragon as it's made out of water and it's made out of mist. And so a river, it looks just like a dragon, and because it winds around and it's got tributaries and canals that go off to the side, and streams, and then sometimes then there's fog that rises out of the river, and it's like steam, and the Red River it moves like that, just like a dragon, and then the whole map of Vietnam looks like a dragon. It looks like a dragon standing up, and its claws are out like that, yeah, and it's got horns like that. What a great question!
Oh, there's
Thank
a question
you.
Back there.
I believe at the beginning you said that one reason you wrote your most recent book as poetry is you felt you didn't have a long time to write, and yet the book took you 4 years to write, and I'm wondering how reality meshed with your expectations.
Oh, yeah. To me, 4 years is very short, because the two books that came before that, Tripmaster Monkey, took me 10 years, and The Fifth Book of Peace took 10 years. Of course, that included the time it was burned in the Oakland-Berkeley fires, and then I had to start again, but still, it took 10 years. And so 4 years is so short, so it met my expectations very well.
back here.
Hi, this is a kind of an old question. Maybe it's not an old question, but it's your first book from The Woman Warrior, and the first chapter, which is really riveting for many people. What I'm wondering is that story from The Woman Warrior, the story of the no-name woman who your father said never existed and who your mother said existed, is in fact the reason that you wrote that for literary reasons, or did that person really exist, the no-name woman?
Oh, I believe that she actually existed, and when I was writing it, I didn't. You know, sometimes I would believe my father and say, "Oh, she's not real." And but my mother said, "So I just wrote it so that either way could be so." Years later, I have a sister who is a social worker, and she works with foster children. And when you work with foster families, you have genealogy charts that you fill in for all the families involved. And so my sister, with those same questions in her mind, she took the genealogy charts to my parents and said, "Oh, you know, we really ought to fill these out so that we would know about our family." And then she starts way up there with great-great-grandparents. She works her way down, and then she says, "Okay, and here you are, Papa. You're right here. Here's Uncle, and here's the other uncle." "And wasn't there a sister? Didn't you have a sister?" And both my parents went, like that.
Wow. You know?
And then my sister knew that it was a true story. And then my father said, I think my mother said to my father, "Oh, go ahead and tell her."
But you know, a lot of people who've written PhD theses on the fact that this is not an answerable question, and you kind of ruined it for them.
I know. You know, that's what they get for writing about a living author.
Next question. Back there. Yeah.
First, I just want to make a comment and thank you for being an inspiration and giving women like me permission to write. And this is another question that kind of contradicts that, is how do you feel about being essentialized as a writer, or how do you feel about the label Asian American literature or Asian American fiction, or just the label of being Asian American?
It would bother me if that were the only label. Then I would feel pigeonholed. But my work is also taught in British and American literature classes. I have seen my work in anthropology classes, in sociology classes. Chinamen is classified by the Library of Congress as California history. I have seen my work taught in Black studies courses, and of course feminist literature or women's studies. And so there are so many classifications that it's okay. I can be called American writer and an Asian American writer. It's just fine.
You know, I'm salivating and so jealous at this point because, you know, I've been making this observation that once you get to level of eminence, then of course you're everybody's writer. But, you know, for the lowly people, I guess, it's almost like, oh, he's an Asian American writer, study writer.
Are you always classified?
Not always, but no. I was happy when it's taught in an English class rather than Asian American study class.
Yeah, actually, me too.
Yeah, because I feel that it's not just this, but everything else as well. And it's unfortunate that we categorize and then pigeonhole so much, like you say. Mm-hmm. It is unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. And there's also another category, just Chinese writer. And leaving out the American part. And that bothered me, at the beginning it bothered me very much, because there's a lack of understanding that I am American and what I'm writing is American literature.
Yeah. More questions? Back there?
In one of the stories in Women Warrior, there's a character, and she's the meek schoolgirl, demure, and I just love the rage at that character. And I have two questions. So does she just represent a kind of person, or was this like a real girl, and what happened to her?
Oh, you know, characters don't represent anything. They just are characters. And what happened to her is that she lives to this day, and she never became like an outgoing person. She never got a job. She never got married. She never went to school. To me, she's a reversion back to another type of person. You know, in the Victorian age, there would be recluses, women who could never leave home, and they would just live on the sofa, or up in the attic, and that's their life, and this is her life.
Okay, we have time for two more questions. One here.
Thank you. Thank you for being here this evening. This question goes back more to wartime, peacetime, and some mistakes that we've made. The United States made the mistake with Vietnam. They were doing it for economic reasons, and I think hubris was involved as well. As China is becoming much more popular, powerful in the world, and their resources are dwindling and they need to seek resources elsewhere, and the recent development of their military and their stealth bombers and those kinds of things, is that a cause for concern for the same type of potential that we've experienced from the U.S. and Vietnam as an example?
Oh, I think any of us making weapons and also dealing in weapons, making them and selling them, of course. It's a concern.
One more question. There's a lady in the back with two hands up, so she wins.
I have a two-part question.
Oh.
My first for you, did you see or have any input when they made the play of Woman Warrior? Did you have an input to that?
Oh, did you see it?
Oh, yes. Oh,
that's nice.
And
yeah.
Andrew, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Myself?
Yes.
Well, I write essays mostly, and I've been doing commentaries for NPR, but I also write fiction. Thank you. And two people heard me on All Things Considered. I have two books out, and they're on sale. And the third one will be a book of fiction, and I had the great distinct pleasure of having Maxine being the MC 15 years ago at UC Davis, and it was a wonderful event. It's wonderful.
Oh, I had some input in that big play, and it was, but not a whole lot, because another person who wrote the script, it was a gigantic production, a $1 million production. So much of it went into costumes and music, but nice work with the fusion of Eastern and Western music. It was very grand. But what comes to my mind is that there was another play of the same script, and it was done up in Grass Valley, up north, and it was a small play with zero budget, and they got the costumes from Goodwill or something, and it was just townspeople putting together a play, and that one was so full of human feeling that I love that one more. The other one was spectacle.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Andrew, wait. Aren't you going to read us a poem?
I don't think there's time. All right. It to women and poetry and ghosts. Can ghosts cross the ocean? When we first came to America a long time ago, my maternal grandmother suffered a sort of crisis of faith. She prayed and lit incense sticks and tapped the copper gong to call our ancestors' spirits, but she was no longer convinced that her prayers were heard. What caused Grandma's consternation was the fact that Grandpa, who had died during the Vietnam War, had never once visited her in her dreams in America. Child, Grandma would sometimes ask me, "Do you think ghosts can cross the ocean?" "I think so, Grandma," I would answer quickly, if only to make her feel better. But how would I know? All I knew was that back home, Grandma often had dreams in which Grandpa would come and talk with her. At times, it seemed as if they were still a couple living together those years near the end of the war. When Grandma lost a jade bracelet, for instance, she prayed to Grandpa and he came into her dream and told her where to look. She found it the next day. Another time, Grandma, who had given up writing poetry when she was young, surprised everyone at breakfast by reciting a mellifluous ode to spring and autumn. When we applauded, she pointed to the dark rosewood altar and said, "I had help. You should compliment Grandpa as well." The last time Grandma had seen Grandpa in her dreams was a few months before the end of the war. "You will go on a very long trip and we won't meet for a long, long time," he predicted. Grandma was perplexed. She couldn't imagine going anywhere but to join him and our ancestors in the spirit world. No one doubted Grandma's dreams. She accepted the presence, the ghosts in Vietnam, the way we have prayed and talk to the dead daily at our ancestral altar. Grandpa's prediction, sadly, came true after communist tanks rolled into Saigon, and my family and I had to flee our homeland. Can ghosts cross the ocean? When I was young, her question struck me as a bit eerie. Now I find it tragic. Once we were bound to the land in which our ancestors were buried, and we lived comfortably with ghosts and the idea of death and dying. In America, our way of life is quickly faded. America looks to the future, not the past. It is moved by the idea of progress and opportunity. And American people move about from job to job, from city to city, restlessly. Indeed, where can one's ancestral ghost dwell in a world of humming computers and concrete freeways and shiny high-rises? As time passed, Grandma's question came to seem irrelevant for most of her grandchildren. We have gone on to become modern cosmopolitan Americans, after all. These days in front of the family altar, with all those faded photos of the dead staring down at me, I often feel oddly removed, as if staring not at the present, but a piece of my distant past. Having fled so far from Vietnam, I can no longer imagine what to say or to whom I should address my prayers, for that matter, what promises I could possibly make to my dead ancestors, since the most sacred one of all, that I should live and die in my own homeland, has already been broken. Perhaps I'll never know if ghosts really cross oceans or not, but in one of the last conversations I had with her when I visited Grandma in her convalescent home, I learned that the question was, for her at least, resolved. "I was sitting in the garden yesterday," Grandma told me in a happy and excited voice that I hadn't heard for a long time. "And there was this butterfly that kept flying about me. Suddenly, I just blurted out and asked, 'Husband, if it is you, then come land on my shoulder.' And it did, on both sides, and it stayed for a long, long time." A few days after my visit, Grandma collapsed and fell into a coma. The doctor said there was little chance of recovery. She could go any time now, they warned, but it was many years before she died. Yet, when I think of my grandmother, it's not a decrepit old body sustained by respirators and IV units that I see. The vision that I keep safe is admittedly a sentimental one, and the one I did not see. A genteel old lady sits serenely in the rose garden at dusk, smiling happily. A flock of butterflies alight upon her bony frame, their wings forming a golden blanket for her in the last light. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.